Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. Welcome back. It's Tony Week. The 73rd Tony Awards ceremony will be broadcast this coming Sunday, June 9th on CBS. James Corden will be host from Radio City Music Hall. Leading the pack of nominees is Hadestown with 14 in total, followed by Ain't Too Proud, Ferryman, and then To Kill a Mockingbird. Many of the nominees have come by the All of It studios this past year for conversations about the shows. We're going to bring you excerpts of those conversations all week as we look ahead in anticipation of the award show. We begin today with To Kill a Mockingbird, which received 9 Tony nominations. The Broadway production of Mockingbird opened at the Schubert Theater last December. Since opening night, the play, based on Harper Lee's 1960 novel of the same name, has grossed more than $45 million, the top box office earner for the 2018-19 Broadway season. The book was adapted by Aaron Sorkin and stars Jeff Daniels as Attucks Finch. I should say the play was adapted from the book. I caught up with the cast members Gbenga Akinabe, who plays Tom Robinson, as well as Gideon Glick and Celia Keenan-Bolger. They play Dill and Scout, respectively, and they were both nominated for Tonys for their roles. And just last night, Celia won a Drama Desk Award for Outstanding Featured Actress in a Play. She is great as Scout. I began my conversation with the cast by asking about their first encounters with Harper Lee's novel. Gideon Glick speaks first.
It was in the 7th grade, and it was a pretty transformative experience for me because it was how I learned how to be a critical reader and a critical thinker. Mm-hmm. So it was how I could suss out metaphor and simile and theme. And so the book has kind of been with me. I'm an avid reader, and the book is with me every time I read a book. Mm. So it's been just a tremendous part of my development.
As an avid reader, when you heard it was going to be adapted, did you have any concern? not talking about Aaron's talent, because we know it's big.
I'm always concerned. This book means so much to people. It is so important to the nation. It's important to people's development, as it was for me. And people are very, very particular about what it should be and what it shouldn't be. So yes, I was reticent. What I find really remarkable is how people have been receiving it. Mm-hmm. And people love to say at the stage door, yeah, I did not want to like this. I did not want to like adults playing kids. I did not want to like any of this. And then they do.
People are moved by it when they name their children. A lot of people name their children Atticus and Scout. They're
such good names.
They are. During the previews, there was like out at the stage door, I was leaving, and there was this beautiful little girl with her little sister and the parents standing up, behind them, and the girls came up to me and asked for an autograph, and they told me how much they loved the the play. And then the father said, "Tell them what your name is." And the little girl said, "Oh, my name is Atticus." And I'm like, I love that. Like I'm my family's Nigerian. I want my children all to have Nigerian names, but I'm seriously considering like throwing in, as if I have a daughter, an Atticus in there as far as a middle name or something like that. It was just so beautiful. I think about it all the time.
When was your first encounter with To Kill a Mockingbird?
Excerpts of it in middle school. I didn't go to a regular public school, and so like education was, the teachers tried, but they were mainly concentrating on keeping kids in line for behavioral issues. And so they had this one teacher who was going to like show us, we didn't read the whole book, but show us a little bit of what we would normally be getting at this age in another school. And so we watched a bit of the movie, and it was powerful to see Gregory Peck there with Scout and having their interactions about what's going on in this town, and then reading some of the excerpts of the school. Of the book. I loved it, and I watched the movie later. I didn't watch the movie while doing this process, but I remember loving the movie when I did watch it years ago.
Celia, did you go back and read the book or watch the movie?
I did go back and read the book. I was too intimidated by Mary Badham's performance to go back and watch the movie, where I was like, that little girl was a genius. So I will only be in a shame spiral if I go and watch how good she is. And, you know, like there are parts like that little scowl, like her face, it's like indelibly printed on my brain. So I was like, yeah, you don't need to revisit that, because you'll try to do some little version of what she did. And mm-hmm. This character, this version of Scout, is a sort of it's different than the movie. But I read as much as I could find about Harper Lee and about that time period. There's a really amazing book by Joe Crispino called, is it, Who is Atticus Finch? Atticus Finch, a biography. Yeah. So that's a lot about the time period of in 1934, of just what was going on in the South.
By Harper Lee's father.
Yes, and their relationship. Which was really, really helpful. It was a piece where I felt like you really needed to do the research, because the novel is so beloved that we all have access to the novel. So I was like, I have to take it the next step so that I know a little bit more about these characters than just the random audience member who's coming in.
My guests were Celia Keenan-Bilger and Gideon Glick and Benga Akanabe. We're talking about To Kill a Mockingbird, which is currently on Broadway. Good luck getting tickets.
Yeah.
Did you work with a dialect coach? Because that is such a specific Southern accent.
Kate Wilson is amazing. She's amazing. She teaches at Juilliard, and she was a great dialect coach, but also this great warm energy of a heart to have around, especially dealing with this material. So it's wild how in this profession there's a lot of negative reinforcement, and that can help, like just being scared to death to get it right. but she came with a lot of positive reinforcement, which is I saw all these dialects growing and bubbling while we were workshopping, and it was just, yeah, she was awesome.
How was your work with the dialect coach, Gideon?
It was very interesting because I in the book, Dill is from Mississippi, and in the show he's from Bayou Blue, but I knew I really wanted to have, I wanted him to feel different. I wanted his accent to be different. I wanted it to have this, I wanted it to be grand and have this kind of drawl that was different from the other citizens, because he's not from Macomb. Mm-hmm. And Kate was really extraordinary in expanding upon that and also blending it in with what everybody else was doing.
Why did you want him to feel grand? Is that because in his mind, his internal world is grand?
Yes, absolutely. He creates such a narrative for himself, and it's his way of winning, or it's his way of how he thinks he wins mm-hmm. over other people. He ingratiates himself with these tall tales, and it's really just masking a deep insecurity and a cruel upbringing.
And for Scout, because Scout has got to be, she's got to be our narrator, mm-hmm. so she needs to be clear,
right.
But she's also a little kid mm-hmm. and with a Southern accent.
Mm-hmm. It's like a lot there.
It's a lot there.
And I think what was so nice about what Kate did is that there was no, as is the truth with accents, you know, all over our country, that there's not one way that people speak if you're from a town. And even we went to Monroeville, where Harper Lee was born, and I was like, the main reason was just to like listen to how people talked.
Cool.
And to try to like figure out what that sounds like. And I like had lunch with a family, and the difference between how the father talked and the woman who was my age, his daughter, spoke was completely different. That I was like, oh, she just had way less of an accent. And so in that way, Kate said often, she was like, you know, it's not that everybody on stage needs to sound the same, but we need to sound like we are in the same play,
mm-hmm.
and that we know what this town is, and we know why the farmers sound different mm-hmm. from the townsfolk. And so that part of it, and then also just trying to sort of modulate for myself, like, what does it sound like when I'm sort of looking back on the story, and what does it sound like when I'm inside of the story as an 8-year-old kid, and trying to figure out, you know, how to play that.
Let's talk about you guys playing kids.
Okay.
It's interesting that you said that people at the stage door weren't so sure it was going to work. In the initial discussions about grown-ups playing these little kids, can you describe some of the direction you got from Bartlett Shear about this?
Yeah, I think what was most helpful is that we all kind of, it wasn't about characterization. It wasn't about these external factors of how we hold our body and how we pitch our voice. It was about the stakes of the scenes and what motivates these characters, and you know, that we're in the South. It's the 30s. There's no television. What activates these kids?
Mm.
And it was from there that the body started following suit, and so did the voices. And Bart was a really wonderful conductor of all that.
Yes. And I think it was, you know, you're always treading that line, because I think the truth is, like, people really don't want to watch adults play kids, including myself. So you have to figure out a way. And I think it also is a real testament to what Aaron was able to do, that he wrote something that supported, like, the language feels just sophisticated enough that you don't feel like these, you know, these kids are idiots. But and because they have such a good sense of humor, that it's doing a lot of work for you. And that is sort of exactly what Gideon was saying. It's like the imagination just goes to, like, what if you're a kid with nothing to do, how do you spend your day? And that really ended up influencing the way that we would shape the scenes and how we would think about, you know, the characters.
What's something that you do physically on stage to telegraph to the audience that you're playing a kid?
I sometimes imitate Jeff, because Atticus, you all know, because he really looks up to Atticus, and I think he thinks of himself as kind of this, like, young little philosopher. And so I sometimes try to emulate his body pattern, his body behavior, mm-hmm. and that ends up, I think, being, you know, very youthful.
What about for you, Celia?
Yeah, I feel like I almost never walk in this play. Like,
you guys stop.
Yeah, we are running and
stomping and galloping and running. And that was, like, something that I was just like, oh, yeah, kids, like, given the, like, opportunity, they're not so interested in walking. But I was like, that's a good way just to be like, they move through the world differently. And usually, and it was also helpful because when we're playing adults, then you're like, okay, now we can sort of, like, take the pace of everything down. And then when we're the kids, it's like, all right, and now we have to, like, ramp it up.
Which is that sense of adventure. Mm-hmm. It goes back to how are we entertaining ourselves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting. As an audience member, I liked having adults play the kids because I always worry about kids on stage. I don't know if it's the mom in me or what. Like, it's such a serious play, and it's so important to make these certain points. I thought, like, ooh, the adults, they can do it.
You don't feel worried for us.
I really
didn't.
And I
also think it's so hard to do the same thing 8 times a week. And especially if you're getting positive feedback, if you're a kid, to not modulate your performance for an audience. Like, if you're getting the laughs, or that it's really hard to be sort of rigorous about how the play was built if you're 8 years old. Yeah. I mean,
you're getting
hard
a laugh
to do that when you're exactly
go for the hammy
it's
laugh.
It's hard for
right?
us, yeah, totally. To modulate.
I'll
say also, it's really helpful in the, because people have so many preconceived notions about what this piece is. When you come to this show and you see 3 adults come out and then play kids, you go, oh, we're in a different space. Mm-hmm. This is theater, and I think it's very, very helpful for the audience.
One of the other differences from the book, there's many, is that when we never see the jurors, Bingo. There's these empty chairs. What do you think that adds to the theatrical nature of the piece? What do you think it adds for the audience and for you as an actor? Because you're the person who's on trial.
I think
Tom is the person.
I think it allows the audience to, like, this play allows the audience, forces the audience to engage on many levels. Like, you can't just sit and watch this show. You have to judge throughout. You have to take sides at one point. You have to look at yourself. People leave and they do tons of reflection. Part of that, I think, is looking at the, you know, having this empty juror's box and picturing who would be there as far as this town, picturing themselves there. I'm sure the audience pictures themselves there at certain times. And so, what would I do? The people, and what would the people in this town who would be there? The farmers. So the kids. We call Gideon and Celia and Will the kids. Like, they do a great job of setting up, like, what this town looks like, who these people are, like, giving all these facts to the audience at first, and then now run with us. And part of that is, you know, you have these farmers who are all white, who are all male, and this is why they're the ones as jurors and not people of upper or lower class and so on. And so it makes the audience engage in a way that, like, they invest in our show.
Does it free you up as an actor at all? I was wondering, just because the way you're sitting is you're facing one direction and then the jury's over here. And, you know, if you've ever been on jury duty, you realize that the person who's accused often kind of interacts with the jury.
I can't flirt with the jury to get off, so no. but it frees. It's interesting because it does free up to a certain extent, but then you're reminded of the stakes, right? And mm-hmm. so like that jury box is like super important. And looking at it, you're like, maybe there's a chance. No, there's no chance. Yeah, it's like a lot of that's what happens in that jury. Because for a great deal of the play, Atticus is surprisingly winning. So that means he's winning over those jury members. And so, like, who are those people who start out one way and then become swayed, you know? And then it goes a different way. So that's interesting to me to picture and also engage with that box. And when do they become swayed? What happens in the play that does it? How am I surprised that they, like, these 12 white and most likely very racist jurors mm-hmm. are starting to be open a little bit by this argument Atticus is presenting? So how do I see that when I'm looking at them?
Gideon, I'm curious about the music. For folks who haven't seen the play, there's a guitar player on one side of the stage, and it's an organ, mm-hmm. an organ on the other side of the stage. And they sort of weave in and out, but they do something to the narrative, and I'm not sure what it is. Yeah. What do you think it is?
I call it the lubricant. You know, when we did two workshops of the show, and we didn't have the music. And I remember when we first got the music, and people were saying, "Oh, how's rehearsal going?" I go, "Well, we just got the music," and all of a sudden, for me, the show came alive because there are so many scenes. And the show kind of bleeds into each other. The scenes bleed mm-hmm. into each other. And the music is so helpful in making that all cohesive. And I think it's also very helpful for our narration and our journey when we're around the town, because there isn't a physical town, really. It's just a wall. And mm-hmm. it helps amp us up. And it's psychologically potent, too.
And I think it really locates you in the South. Like, you almost immediately are like, this doesn't sound like what I'm familiar with. Mm-hmm. And that it did so much work that Bart talked a lot where he was like, I don't want it to feel like a bunch of New York actors with Southern mm-hmm. accents doing To Kill a Mockingbird. I want us to have a window into this town in 1934. And I think when the musicians came in and Adam started writing the music, I was like, oh, for the first time, I sort of see where we are.
Exactly.
It definitely places us. And it was amazing to see the music being written live in front of us in rehearsal, at least for me, because I'm not used to that. And Adam was like, we had such a talented musical group. Alan, who plays the guitar, Kim Grisby, who's a musical director. And just to see them all just like form this other structure to the play, and then and it's integrated into like what we do. It's amazing.
Also, when we started previews, that hymn at the very end that everybody sings wasn't even a part of the show. Like, that was something that came later, where they felt like we need something to sort of tie everything up. And so that was like a beautiful addition. Like, at probably the second week or the end of the first week of previews, that the music just like elevated the whole experience, I think.
My guests have been Sid Keenan-Bolger, Gideon Glick, and Gabenge Akinabe. They star in the Tony-nominated Broadway production of To Kill a Mockingbird, running now at the Schubert Theater. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. We'll be right back.